In this Critic podcast, I'm talking to Barry Norris. Barry Norris, you are the founder and chief investment officer of Argonaut Capital Partners, and with very clear views on Britain's wind industry. In fact, you've written the cover story for us in the November issue of The Critic, which is called Britain, A Goner with the Wind. In a normal year, if there is such a thing, how many days a year roughly would our wind capacity generate significant energy?
To be honest, Graham, the best way to look at it is to is that the national grid breaks down the day into half an hour periods where you can measure the wind market share, and so that's the research that we did on the grid looked at 70,000 discrete half an hour periods since the beginning of 2021. And it basically shows that the wind fluctuates between 0% market share and 60% market share, dependent obviously on the weather. And the problem is that when it's 60% market share, we have almost zero or sometimes negative power prices. In other words, we have a glut of power that can't be stored or exported or used. And when the wind doesn't blow, we typically have very volatile and high power prices. And I think it's not really very well understood how a grid works. So in that scenario, the national grid, when the wind's blowing, it's typically blowing in the North Sea when it's blowing in the Irish Sea. And therefore, no matter how many wind turbines we build in the UK, they typically will always only work at the same time. And so if you think that already when the wind blows, we have 60% market share of wind, building more wind is a little bit like a factory owner hiring employees or factory workers that guarantee only to turn up when they're not needed. And when the wind doesn't blow, what has to happen is all of the other generation, typically gas-fired generation in the UK, will have to be turned on when the wind doesn't blow. And that, of course, means that the cost of gas generation goes up because the capacity utilization is could be 80-90%, but if it's got to be switched on and off, then there are greater costs of that. So that results in higher power prices as well. And all of this is paid for not by the wind farms, sadly. They don't really care if their product's useless or if it has a low value, because the power price is guaranteed by the government and paid for by the consumer. So pretty much everywhere in Europe where you have, and actually in the US, in states of the US, where you have very high market shares of wind and solar, you actually, and weather-dependent generation, you actually have very high and volatile power prices, which the consumer ends up paying for, and which wind farm operators are very happy to keep building because they're getting paid a guaranteed price, which doesn't actually reflect the value of their useless product that they produce.
So, I mean, though you make a number of points there, which I just want to focus on a few of those in turn. So, firstly, if I've understood you rightly, you're saying that we don't solve the intermittency of when the wind is blowing or not just by building more wind farms, because actually multiplying the number of wind farms doesn't multiply the amount of wind that blows. And so, really, there's
So
not.
wind is already the constraining factor rather than installed capacity.
Right. And secondly, the argument that, well, when the wind blows strongly, where wind farms produce so much energy at a really cheap cost, that it can be stored to be used for a later day when the wind isn't blowing. Just give me a bit more of a sense of the reality of why that isn't the case.
So there currently exist no batteries which can store on an industrial scale for long periods of time in a cost-effective basis, can store power. And if you've got a grid which is solely based on weather-dependent power, you would have to store power for weeks, possibly months on end, because we don't know when the wind's going to blow again. And to give you some idea of how costly storage is, there's a battery currently being built in Trafford, Manchester, at the stated cost of £750 million. And that battery will store 1 gigawatt for 2 hours, or two gigawatt hours. And that's enough power for 3 minutes and 17 seconds of usage on average in the UK. So if you were to say that we need, you know, thousands of these batteries to store power over for weeks and months, then the cost of using batteries to store wind generated power in the UK would quickly add up to more than 100% of GDP. And of course, these batteries typically don't last more than 8 to 10 years, so would need to be replaced. So using batteries is a non-starter. And the net zero evangelists have sort of cottoned on to this and then moved on to hydrogen, and hydrogen has its own problems, not least the fact that the loss of energy when you transfer it from a gas to a liquid transported is huge. It's difficult to store safely. And the point, and hydrogen electrolyzers are only really profitable when they can be used nearly 100% of the time. So the only actual profitable hydrogen in the world at the moment is produced by fossil fuels or nuclear. And green powered hydrogen is typically 5 times more expensive. So again, another non-starter. So then if you think you can't store it, of course, the other thing that you could do is potentially export it. And, you know, this is behind Boris Johnson's idea that the UK could become the Saudi Arabia of wind. Of course, there are some clear differences in that Saudi Arabia, typically its finding cost, drilling cost for a barrel of oil is $5 to $10, and they're selling it in the market at the moment at 90. And the problem that Britain would have is that it would be its production costs for wind power at the moment are probably on average well over 100 euros per megawatt. But when the wind's blowing in the UK, and we've got this glut of wind power, it's blowing everywhere else in Europe as well. So everywhere else in Europe has got low power prices at the same time as we'll have this surplus. So the price of which we would be able to export that wind power would either be zero or close to zero. So it'd be very different from Saudi Arabia, in that it would be like Saudi Arabia, cost of drilling oil being $100 a barrel and selling it for $5 a barrel. And that clearly, a loss-making export industry is clearly not a sustainable industry for anybody. It would quickly lead to the bankruptcy of Great Britain.
And yet Denmark, which has invested heavily in wind power, it's able to export some of its surplus wind power. Why can't we be like Denmark?
So you're correct. Denmark has about 48% of its power generated by wind. It also has a very high share of biomass, which is typically wood pellets, which typically have nearly twice as much CO2 emissions per unit of energy than coal. So, but to come to your point, Denmark is integrated into the Nordic power market, and essentially it operates in the same market as Norway and Sweden, so that when the wind's not blowing, Denmark will import hydro from Norway or nuclear from Sweden and vice versa. And it could also sell into the German market. And the geographic proximity to those other countries is very small compared to the UK. Moreover, Denmark being a small economy, when it's got these surpluses, they can be more easily absorbed by the bigger economies around it. Britain wouldn't have that because its economy is too big.
Right. So I want to just probe another aspect, which I think needs a little closer understanding. Your point is not just that wind power becomes very expensive because of it being an intermittent power, but when the wind is blowing, wind power is very cheap indeed. Is the problem, therefore, that it's on the days that it can't be usefully or stored at a competitive price for the non-wind-blowing days, because then gas and other sources have to be used to power electricity in Britain, that the problem is why is it the problem that we have this low cost, at least for some days in the year when the wind does blow? Surely that's still a saving compared to the days when we are dependent on alternative sources like gas. Why does the price accelerate for gas when we don't use it so often?
So I think, going back to my factory worker analogy, if wind is our unreliable worker that guarantees to only turn up when it's not needed, the factory owner then, because he has to man the factory, he has to hire more and more workers because he doesn't know which workers are going to turn up between 9 and 5. So the problem is actually wind power just becomes this economic indulgence that actually can never replace the reliable workers, because you still need to hire the reliable workers who are guaranteed to turn up between 9 and 5, and you still need to pay for the reliable workers in addition to the unreliable workers who you don't really know when they're going to turn up. So this is why there's been...
This is a doubling up of costs, essentially, rather than a splitting of costs.
Yes, this is why there's been $4 trillion invested in alternative energy, weather-dependent energy, over the last 10 years, but the share of fossil fuel energy has gone from only 82% to 81% of global energy consumption. And that's why the whole idea of a renewable energy grid is just a political indulgence.
And this massive investment that's going on in Britain and in other countries around the world in an energy source that you describe as a political indulgence. I mean, ultimately, investors want to make a return on their investment. All this money is therefore going in purely because they know they've got a guaranteed price, regardless of whether the energy is any use or not. Or what are these investors seeing that your analysis suggests isn't there?
So look, for the wind power investor, there's a reason why nobody will build a wind farm without a guaranteed price. This is an industry that wouldn't exist without government subsidies. And the problem is that it's not the invisible hand of the market that is allocating capital to these industries. It's governments that are allocating capital through effectively guaranteeing a price for a useless product, but also putting carbon taxes on the rivals. So, you know, the price of gas at the moment is effectively doubled in the UK by the carbon tax. So governments, through government coercion, governments ban all the useful products. They then subsidize the useless products. And when capital was cheap investors were prepared to fund these projects. The problem is at the moment, the interest rates over the last 2 years globally have gone up by from basically from 0 to 5% or 0.5% to 5.5%. So a 500 basis point increase in interest rates. These projects are typically funded with a lot of debt. So typically 80% debt. So a 500 basis point increase in the cost of debt every year is adding about 4% or 4p for every pound spent in debt servicing costs every year. And over the duration of a 25 year project, which wind farms are supposed to last 25 years, they probably don't last that long, but let's leave that aside, then you've effectively doubled the capital cost or the expense interest cost for these projects over the lifetime, which means that investors no longer want to back these projects because they cannot make a profit at even the subsidized guaranteed price for their low value product.
Well, in September, we had the British government's latest auction for offshore wind development, and it managed to attract absolutely no bidders at all. So, I mean, given that the government is committed to hugely boosting our wind power capacity, and given that even at guaranteed fixed prices, it can attract no wind power developers from anywhere in the world, near or far, where do we go from here?
We should be clear, the wind operators are actually, by and large, refusing to even build the projects that they won in the fourth auction a year ago. So it's not just that there were no bids in the fifth auction, but the winners of the fourth auction are now refusing to build the projects like Hornsea 3. Orsted is refusing to build that. And that was the biggest project in the fourth auction, and the second biggest project, the Norfolk Borealis, is also being put on hold by Vattenfall, the Swedish operator. So the wind operator industry is basically on strike because they've realized that the prices that they previously agreed with the UK government to build these projects are going to be loss-making. And therefore, they've come back to the government for more subsidies. And this is, of course, a bit of a joke, because 2 years ago, the politicians and the wind industry boasted at how cheap wind power was relative to gas. And that was, of course, a pretty empty boast at the time, given their different products, as we've already discussed. One is weather dependent, one is power on demand. And that, you know, the cost of gas is effectively doubled by tax anyway, so you can make something more competitive by taxing the competition out of business. And at that point, you also had this big spike in temporary spike in gas prices caused by the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And in addition to that, the fact that North Sea oil production, which would have insulated that against us, has been on the decline. So the problem we face is that the projects that were agreed at a very low price aren't going to be profitable enough. Therefore, wind operators are refusing to build them, and they're effectively on strike at the moment. And because the successive Conservative governments have placed so much emphasis on offshore wind being the solution, the whole situation is in something of an impasse. And nobody, the governments or the wind operators, of course, don't want to admit to the general public that wind isn't as cheap as what they had been led to believe. And in fact, we're probably going to have to go back to paying £100 plus per megawatt in order to get offshore wind operators to keep building wind farms, which is, of course, twice the price of gas-fired power.
So, I mean, something does have to give, presumably, given that not only the Conservative government, but the likely next Labour government has just decided that wind is the future. And it's politically very difficult for them to row back from that. They've invested so much of their own reputation in moving towards net zero for that to be U-turned on. Presumably the answer will just be to spend more taxpayers' money giving a higher subsidy so that wind producers do go ahead with their developments.
Well, I think if it was left to the politicians, we would plough on regardless, building more and more useless wind power, which can't be stored or exported. And we wouldn't think particularly deeply about the value of the product. And as we previously said, if the invisible hand of the market was involved, there would be no more wind power built in the UK forever. But I think actually, although probably the politicians are going to stupidly cave in and allow the CFD auction price to go a lot higher than what it was today. And of course, you've seen the public comments recently from the wind farm operators, whether it be RWE or Ørsted, saying that they're not going to build more wind unless the power price is considerably higher. Now, at the end of the day, though, governments are finding that they actually don't have a magic money tree. And the problem with wind, as with pretty much every product in the energy transition, is that it's an inferior product. So, you know, from electric cars to heat pumps to wind power, everything in the energy transition is an inferior product. And the invisible hand doesn't finance or purchase the inferior product unless it's forced to do so by governments. And that's why the energy transition is reliant on government coercion and government subsidy to work. And it's also reliant on very low interest rates to finance these inferior products so that investors could get a return. So these are all exogenous factors that have to be in place to sustain what are ironically unsustainable business models and unsustainable industries. Now, the problem with markets at the moment is governments are already taxing the productive economy at record high rates. I think we've got the highest tax take in the UK at the moment since World War II. And obviously, taxing the productive economy and reallocating that resource to the unproductive economy can't go on forever. Otherwise, the productive economy simply collapses, and there is no there's no economy to generate tax revenue.
Mm-hmm. It's not like the large sums which have been committed in the past to the Victorian age, building the railways or building the national grid in the 20th century, where at least the consequences of this massive investment was a material improvement in the technology and the growth that would come from this. There's just all this money being expended on something that doesn't make anyone or anything more productive or wealthier.
Absolutely. I mean, when in the Industrial Revolution coal replaced wood as the prime energy source, it was because coal was a better product than wood. It had more compact energy in a lump of coal than in a similar sized piece of wood. And it could be easily transported. And because it had this compact chemical energy, it could eventually be converted to mechanical energy. Similarly, oil and gas replaced coal as the dominant energy in the 20th century because it had more bang for buck. It could be very easily transported in a liquid. And all of these applications like the motor car, the aeroplane, could be fueled by this incredible fossil fuel powered energy. Now, the problem, obviously, with this energy transition, it's an inferior product. So whereas switching to the superior product led to economic growth and multiplier effects, which were good for the economy, this energy transition, because it involves an inferior product that wouldn't exist without the support of government, will actually lead to economic weakness and lower standards of living. And eventually, governments will run out of money to keep subsidizing unproductive products.
But of course, you know what the disciples of this century's most influential child, Greta Thunberg, will say, and that is, it might not be good for the economy, but it's good for the planet. I'm struck by an irony in that amongst developed world countries, Britain's record in reducing its CO2 emissions is quite good. But it's quite good because it switched in the 1990s to gas powered turbines, and now which have amongst fossil fuels relatively low emissions, certainly compared to the coal that replaced. What about the argument that at least by taking a lead on securing the future of the planet, Britain can take a hit, but in doing so, other countries can be inspired by our self-sacrifice and sacrifice themselves too?
A few points there. Firstly, Britain already halved its carbon emissions in absolute terms, and in relative terms, it went from 6% of global emissions to just 1%. So, and that appeared to have no discernible change on the measurement of the evolution of the climate. So anybody that thinks that they can be confident that Britain removes the rest of its climate emissions and suddenly that has the positive effect on ameliorating climate change, I think can't be very confident about that. And that's why, to a certain extent, Britain could bankrupt itself going to net zero and it could have no measurable impact on climate change at all. And I think the second aspect I would say is that people now have kind of confused the environment with this whole consuming climate change agenda. So that it seems that nobody particularly objects when you ruin landscapes by building solar or wind farms or and just to put it in perspective, the offshore wind projects that are being built at the moment are vast. The biggest ones are the size of Greater London. So you're eventually going to run out of shallow water seabed to build these projects, and that's another reason why the cost is getting greater. And obviously, there's been some recently documented impacts on whale and bird life. But I think finally, I think if we're going to go to net zero and ruin the economy and go back to medieval standards of living, that's going to come with a severe loss of geopolitical power. And those countries that are clearly taking a more pragmatic view on climate change and are obviously still going to use fossil fuels will end up having the better economies and will end up being the prime geopolitical power in the world. And if you so for me, this is not just about investing or standards of living or productivity or governments misallocating capital. If we destroy our economy trying to go to net zero, which might not have any effect at all on the climate, then we're also going to destroy our geopolitical power. And that means that countries that may not share our love of democracy and free speech may well be in charge of global politics going forward.
So Barry, I mean, really, just to conclude, the lesson that China draws from Britain and other Western countries, you know, investing and failing through wind power is what?
So I think, Graham, that China will look at the energy transition quite cynically, in that China is a global leader in exporting EVs, exporting wind power, and exporting solar power, but itself is highly reliant on fossil fuels and coal. And that's why China adds each year to its economy the equivalent in carbon emissions to Britain's entire carbon emission slate. Now, one of the reasons why China loves the idea of Western economies buying electric vehicles is that China itself is the leading manufacturer of batteries for EVs. And how it got there was that basically to create a battery for EVs is an incredibly energy intensive business, requiring a lot of power generation, typically, obviously, in China, a lot of coal power generation. And this is something that China specializes in, because it's not clearly as bothered as we are in the West about its carbon emissions. So essentially, if we all overnight went from internal combustion engine cars to EVs, that would inevitably give China and Chinese car companies and battery manufacturers a big competitive advantage, because China is at the center of the battery manufacturing, which is ironically itself very energy and CO2 intensive. So China's delighted that the West has got the net zero bug, and will obviously expand its economy according to the opportunities that it sees.
So it's a double hit for China, really. Not only does Britain and other Western countries hinder their own economic development through wind power, they move towards actually very resource intensive and high CO2 producing products, which because Western countries themselves don't want to produce these things because they produce so much CO2 and resource intensive, China does. So China wins both ways.
Absolutely. It's the whole fallacy of the electric car, in that all that you've really done is move the CO2 emissions off balance sheet to China in the manufacturing of the battery. And you know, that's why the electric car is just a futile product. But you know, that's a topic for another time.
It certainly is. We've covered a lot in this podcast. I'm very grateful to my guest, Barry Norris of Argonaut Capital Partners, whose article, Britain's a Goner with the Wind, is published in the November issue of The Critic magazine, which is out now.